Well, all right. Hi, everybody. I'm Martin Bandyke from Ann Arbor's 107.1, normally the morning host at the radio station. I'm on vacation this week, and this is my last official duty before I head off for vacation to go to Florida to see the Tigers play some preseason games. And it's a real thrill to be with a lot of the contributors and the editor and the person really responsible for this incredible book, which came out a few years ago in the name of Editorial Freedom, 125 Years at the Michigan Daily. Appreciate you joining us. First off, I'd like to introduce Stephanie Steinberg, the former editor-in-chief of the Michigan Daily, and she's the editor of this new book in the name of Editorial Freedom, and she's going to be leading the presentation tonight. Stephanie, stand up. Good to see you. Stephanie just moved back to the Detroit area and literally started a new job and continuing her career in journalism. She's going to give you details about that as the night goes along. Also joining us tonight are four of the contributors to Stephanie's new book. And let's start with Laura Berman, who was a reporter and news editor at the Michigan Daily. And she was also the co-editor of the Michigan Daily Sunday magazine, which I wasn't aware of until I read your contribution to the book. And we all know Laura as the longtime award-winning columnist for many, many years, first with the Detroit Free Press and then for a couple decades with Detroit News, and just recently retired late last year. An incredible writer, Laura Berman's with us. Good to see you. Stand up, Laura, for one sec, please. And with us as well is Roger Rappaport, who was a news reporter and editor of the Michigan Daily and is now an accomplished author and writer and filmmaker, arguably perhaps best known for the book Citizen Moore about Michael Moore. Roger, good to have you here as well, my friend. And as well joining us, Chris DeZombach, former Michigan Daily photographer and assistant photo editor. He's currently an iOS developer at the New York Times. Chris, welcome, good to have you here. And last but not least, Andy Sachs, who was a photographer at the Michigan Daily and has since pursued a longtime career as a freelance journalist since 1970, and has done lots of great photographic work and did a magnificent film that I had the pleasure of writing about for the Detroit Free Press. Was it just last year?
A year ago
right now. It was a film that won the top award at the Freak Film Festival last year called Let's Have Some Church Detroit Style. So joining us as well is Andy Sachs. Andy. Well, Stephanie, come on up and let's get things rolling here. And you've got to tell everyone what kind of week this has been for you, because it's been pretty intense.
Yeah, I will share everything. Well, first off, thank you all for coming tonight. It's great to be back in Ann Arbor after I was in D.C. for about 4 years. And I just want to thank Martin for organizing this and also the library for putting this together. Here, let's get started. All right, so as is mentioned, I was, up until recently, an editor at U.S. News and World Report in Washington, D.C., and I edited the health and money sections there. And as you can see, I was really not afraid to show my maize and blue spirit with my colleagues. This was actually taken during the Best Colleges rankings launch, and there was a little contest to show your school spirit, and obviously the University of Michigan alumni won that contest, so go blue. But actually, as of Monday, I started a new job here in Detroit, and I am now a features reporter at the Detroit News. So I'm very happy to be home. Thank you.
And still found time to be here tonight. Thank you.
Yes, this is day two for me. But my career really began at the Michigan Daily, and that's where I was editor-in-chief in 2011. And most of you, show of hands, how many have read the Daily? Okay, great, so I don't need to go into too much detail. Do we have any Michigan alumni here? Okay, wonderful. So the Daily is obviously the student newspaper at the University of Michigan, and it prints every weekday, Monday through Friday, and you can find it online 24/7. News, sports, arts, editorials, great photos. And about 250 students now work at the paper. And that's up from my time as editor-in-chief when there was about 150, 175. And the Daily is completely student run, which means that all revenue comes from ads that the students sell, and there's no adult advisor in the newsroom as the students are producing the paper each night. So needless to say, being editor-in-chief is a very fulfilling but tiring job, and it's really not uncommon to find students sleeping on couches or, in my case, on the floor at 3, 4 a.m., you know, after sending the pages to print each night. But how did I end up with this book? After graduation, I moved to D.C., and I still thought about The Daily a lot because it had such an impact on my career. But I thought, you know what, the 125th anniversary is coming up in a few years. This was 2013 at the time. And I thought something should be done to commemorate the students and the paper. And so I thought a great way to do that would be to let the photographers and the reporters who worked at The Daily go behind the scenes and let them explain what really happened before their story or their photo landed on campus newsstands. So I contacted about 40 alumni who are now at top publications like the New York Times, Wall Street Journal, USA Today, ESPN, you name it. And I asked them, you know, would you share a first-person story? And they all happily agreed. And you can see all their names right here. But we're very lucky to have four contributors with us tonight. Sometimes I go to these talks and it's just me talking, so you guys are in for a very special treat. So the book starts in 1965 with the March on Selma, and Roger in a bit will tell you all about that experience. And it goes through Vietnam War protests and presidential elections. You'll also hear a lot of sports stories, like what it was like to cover Rose Bowls or interview Bo Schembechler one-on-one in his office. There's also some really fun stories about a daily sports tradition, where whenever a daily sports writer travels to a rival stadium, there's a tradition where you have to steal something from the stadium. So you'll have to read the book to find out what things have been stolen throughout the years. There's also never before printed photos of Robert F. Kennedy campaigning in Detroit, and this was taken 3 weeks before he was assassinated in 1968. The photographer is Jay Cassidy, and you can see Jay in the background there with the camera. You might know some of the work that he's done because Jay is now a Hollywood film editor, and he's worked on a few movies, including Silver Linings Playbook, American Hustle, and the movie Joy that's out in theaters. It might be out over now, but it was recently out this last season. And you can see Jay here, he's the one sprawled out in front. And Dan O'Krent is the one in the back corner with his shirt off for some strange reason, we don't know why. But
this is the Chicago Bureau.
Yes, and Andy can tell you all about this in a bit. This is the 1968 Democratic Convention in Chicago that they all went to cover. Andy, are you in this photo?
Yeah,
oh.
Yeah, the skinny kid in the back there, I think.
Okay, well. Great. You'll have to tell us more about that.
Well, we were all bunking in the same room, the eight of us, you know.
Who's the guy in the middle of the campus?
The guy in the middle is Jay Cassidy.
Is that Jay Cassidy?
Yes, that's Jay.
So where's Andy?
Go ahead.
Point out where you are.
I'm just going to run up and give you a mic if you want to, just so we can hear if you're offsite.
Did you want to say a little bit about that?
Well, we saved a little.
Is this on?
Yeah.
I can speak.
We saved a little bit of money by all eight of us staying in the same hotel room at the Holiday Inn. If you split the mattress and the box spring, you know, it works out. Thank you very much.
All right. Well, so to understand why students even had the opportunity to travel to Chicago or, you know, cover presidential elections, you have to understand how and why The Daily began. So for that, we're going to travel back in time to the fall of 1890. And at this time, there were about 2,300 students on campus. And in-state tuition was only $20, if you can believe it. It's unfortunately not $20 today. Now, there was not a campus newspaper, but there were two weekly journals called The Chronicle and The Argonaut. And they were actually published by fraternities. And a few of the fraternity brothers realized, you know what, there's not a campus newspaper, we should start our own. So they broke away, and on September 29th, 1890, the Michigan Daily was born. This is actually the first front page in the Daily, and as you can see, it was called the U of M Daily at the time. The Michigan Daily masthead changed a few decades after that. But you could subscribe to it for $2.50 a year, which is different from today, because today the Daily is now free. And in its first week in print, the staff called itself a revolution in college journalism. And that they wrote in an editorial that they proposed to set the ball rolling by establishing a paper which would attempt to do but one thing: give the news promptly and accurately. The Daily pretends to do nothing else. And that really remains the same mission today as the students produce the paper at 420 Maynard, which was built in the 1930s that you can see here. So over the last 125 years, about 6,000 students have worked at the Daily. And what's really remarkable is that the university does not have a journalism department. The department was actually ended in 1979. So if you wanted to be a journalist, the Daily is really where you went to learn about the craft. And in one of the stories in the book, Margaret Myers, who is now at PBS NewsHour in DC, she wrote, "I got my diploma from the College of the Michigan Daily." And I think that's really true for the most of us who went into journalism. And so even though we're just learning from each other, honestly, you know, getting experience reporting in the field, working for the Daily, it's the best training for a career in journalism. And today you can find Daily alumni at the top newspapers, magazines, TV stations, radio stations. This is just a small sample of the places that you'll find their bylines. All right, and the Daily has turned out 8 Pulitzer Prize winners over the years. And this is the interactive portion of the presentation where you guys get to guess who some of these people are. So let's see how you do. You guys are good. Yes, this is Arthur Miller. He won the Pulitzer in 1949, but he started his writing career at the Daily in 1935, and he later became a night editor. But as you know, he didn't really stick with journalism. He once said, "I lost my impulse to do journalism because I tended to want to make the stories better, and that left fact behind a good deal of the time." I'm just glad I was not his editor. Yep, Gene Robinson. Gene is a Pulitzer winner from 2009. He is a columnist at the Washington Post and a commentator on MSNBC, and he won for his coverage of the 2008 presidential election. But Gene's career actually started at the Daily, and he was the editor-in-chief in 1973. If you're from around here, you might recognize him. Not the guy on the right. You got it, Laura. It's cheating, but no. This is Stephen Henderson. He is a editorial page editor at the Detroit Free Press, but he actually began as the editorial page editor of the Daily in 1992. And he won the Pulitzer for his commentary on Detroit's bankruptcy a few years ago. Now, this man did not win a Pulitzer, but he is just as well known. And he is well known for sleeping on daily news desks. Any guesses? How about now? There we go. Yep. Tom Hayden, 1960s activist. He was also a daily editor-in-chief in the early 1960s. He helped found the Students for a Democratic Society. And he wrote the Port Huron Statement in 1962, which later became the Manifesto for SDS. And you might know him because he was also once married to Jane Fonda. But Tom wrote the foreword in the book, and actually had the pleasure of meeting him when I was at a book talk in LA, and he spoke to that group. But he wrote this, and it really resonated with me. He said, "We who lived, breathed, and sometimes slept at the daily went through an educational process that tested us, that mattered, that would remain forever in our bones." Now, besides turning out some famous alumni, the Daily has broken some pretty big news stories throughout the years. And one of those was on April 12, 1955, when the Daily was among the first newspapers to report that university researcher Jonah Salk developed an effective polio vaccine.
Hi, I'm Leslie Wayne. I'm a Daily alum. And the article that I want to talk about in this book is the chapter called The Day Paul Was Proclaimed Dead. Before I start, though, I just want to give a shout out to Stephanie Steinberg, who put the book together and who's been promoting it. And she's really been fantastic. So I know that she's at the event tonight. So thank you, Stephanie, for all the hard work that you've done. I was the Michigan Daily Arts editor. And the story that we're talking about is about the alleged death of Paul McCartney. And this story took place in the late 60s. And what happened was that there were rumors going around the Midwest about the alleged death of Paul McCartney. And then the story kind of seeped into the Michigan Daily. The story, of course, was completely untrue. I'm a journalist. I've worked at the New York Times for almost 30 years. And the one rule about journalism is that you always tell the truth. You never fabricate anything. If there's a mistake, you correct it. Well, this story was completely fabricated. It was completely false, and it became one of the most famous stories that was done in the Daily. And the story, according to the story, the headline was, "McCartney Dead, New Evidence Brought to Light." And the story was about how Paul McCartney had been killed in a car accident, and then a substitute, Paul McCartney, had been put into the Beatles, and that there were clues throughout all the Beatles' music and on the Beatles' records and in the photos telling you about this. And the story went viral. It was an international hit. And the backstory is, I was the arts editor, and Fred Labor was my deputy. He currently is a country western singer in the group called Riders in the Sky. He goes by the stage name of Two Slims. He had been listening to some of these talk radio stations in the Midwest one night. And then in Detroit, he was listening to a talk radio station. And they were talking about things like the Sgt. Pepper album, that that Paul McCartney's back was turned, that the Abbey Road album on the famous picture, he was barefoot, that there were all these clues. Fred then took that and sort of created a satire and ran with it. The article had a big photo of Paul McCartney with a black box around it, which underneath it said OPD, officially pronounced dead. He claimed that if you played I Am a Walrus backwards, it would say Paul is dead. It would, other records, that if you played them backwards, you'd hear the same thing. He said that walrus was the Greek word for corpse, which was an indication of death. Of course, that's not true. And each it was like a mashup of all these different rumors. One line that I liked, which was from the Abbey Road, that famous cover crossing the street, was, "And if you look closely, they have just walked out of the cemetery on the left side of the street. Thus, Paul was resurrected, given a cigarette, and led out of the tomb, thereby conquering death with a little help from his friends. The real Paul is dead, of course, but his symbolic resurrection works fine without him." Once the story hit, the story went viral. I didn't know it was going to run. I gave Fred some reviews to run that night, and instead he wrote this. So I was shocked the next day when it came up. But it also, so was the world, was shocked. It went viral.
Started in Detroit, a group of university students were playing tapes backwards and forwards, different speeds. They gave their evidence to a disc jockey in Detroit. His name was Russ Gibb. And together, collectively, they thought Paul McCartney had died. I understand they still do.
Is Paul McCartney alive or dead?
Yesterday, all my troubles seemed so far away.
Now, at the age of 27, he is either a millionaire Beatle with a beautiful wife, or he's dead and has been for about 2 years.
There were discussions from London to Hollywood to New York. Everybody was finding these clues. Records were being played backwards. Fred was flown around the country to talk about this. The Beatles had to debunk it, and they kept issuing press releases that it wasn't true. The end finally came when Life magazine, which was one of the most famous magazines at the time, ran a cover photo, and the cover photo was of Paul, and it said, Paul is still with us. So, so at that point, everything kind of collapsed. It was a fun, it was a great ride. The story took off like a rocket. And as I say, even though in journalism we always say, you know, write the truth, write the truth, write the truth. In this case, we wrote a false story, but I'm very glad that the story was false. So thank you very much, and I hope you buy the book.
I'm going to let Roger come up here and tell you his story. So, Roger has the first story in the book on the March on Selma in 1965, and I had the pleasure of working with him to go back in time and hear about that experience. So you have the pleasure of hearing it straight from him today. Come on up.
This was a day that Lyndon Johnson, in response to what happened in Selma, proposed the, announced the Civil Rights Act, which was a direct result of the actions in Selma, and actually on that night, I was on my way to Selma to cover this story for the Daily with my big expense account. And one of the first lessons that I learned at the Michigan Daily was never work for free. and that's a lesson that we all learned at the paper. And hitchhiking, part of the trip, and of course sleeping in church basements and things like that. That was all part of the fun of the trip. Although in retrospect, it doesn't seem like all that great an idea, particularly at the time, considering what was going on with all the attacks on the civil rights workers and the murder of James Reeb and so on. The thing that I remember the most about being a civil rights reporter for the first time was how quickly the Daily was able to take this story and make it local, because we had a lot of people from Ann Arbor, in fact, some of whom I went down there with, who were in these protests. We were very well represented. In fact, we were the worst nightmare of the Selma community, because we were the outside agitators that were not only making news, but we were covering it. And, of course, that was one of the reasons that Martin Luther King picked Selma, because they knew they really had a shot at getting national coverage that would in fact force Lyndon Johnson to change his position on basically the Civil Rights Act. And it was a tremendously successful strategy, admittedly at the cost of Viola Luiso died, James Reeb died, there was another civil rights worker, Jimmy Johnson, who was murdered. It triggered the whole thing. So obviously it was a huge human tragedy. On the other hand, going into it, they knew there were going to be some risks, and it was a calculated risk that they took. From the Daily's point of view, the reason we were there is the reason that the Daily continues to cover the stories that we cover. You know, what's always driven the Daily is trying to pick the big stories, and whether it's a story about the Vice President for Student Affairs banning sit-ins, which actually happened on my watch when I was there, Dick Cutler, to the one of the most powerful regents in the university helping himself to the entire library system, including the card catalogs, all the books, and every doctoral thesis, and making millions of dollars off it, even though he happened to be a liberal, quote, regent. We still covered the story anyway, and he was forced to resign. The only regent who's ever, we know of, that was ever actually forced to resign by the Attorney General of the State of Michigan. And that story was really published at some cost to the liberal interest of the university. And believe me, the editors of the Daily had a tough time with that one, because we knew, in effect, we were bumping, if this story ran and Regent Gene Power were to resign, he could be replaced with a conservative, which could tip the balance of power on the Board of Regents. This is the same Regent Power whose events you all go to all the time at the Power Center. So not playing favorites is one of the things that I think the Daily has always done best, particularly on the sports side, by the way, which I don't think gets enough credit for the incredible coverage of sports that this paper has done over the years. We have been objective, we've been fair, but we've been tough and continue to be so. A couple of other things that I want to say about the Daily. You never can predict what a story is going to do. When I wrote the story about Regent Power, I never realized when I wrote it that it was a comeback to haunt me. I mean, I just thought I was writing a story about a conflict of interest on the part of a regent who was taking thousands of books out of the library system to copy them and sell them so that we couldn't have access to them when we were studying. And what happened was that when I was nominated to be editor of the Daily, Harlan Hatcher, the president himself, made a personal effort to make sure that didn't happen, and did his very best to actually prevent me from becoming editor. Fortunately, once again, we were able to sort of mobilize the community around us through the Michigan Daily, naturally, and I was able to change the, well, actually the university was able to change the Board of Student Control. We had a Board of Student Control in those days. We were not independent. We were able to change their minds, and I did become the editor. I say this sort of humbly because all of us, I think none of us, you know, when we see these lists of Steve Henderson and all these great journalists, Arthur Miller and so forth, I don't think anybody at the Daily is thinking of anything other than tonight's deadline. I think that would be a fair way to summarize it. Andy, I know for a fact, you know, people working late, you're just thinking about getting the paper out and getting it right and getting some sleep. And that whatever happens to these stories is often beyond our ability to predict it. But I will say there are two primary lessons that have helped me tremendously in my own career. And one is, this is something I would say universally to any young journalist at any age. We all need a proofreader. Trying to proofread your own stuff is not a good idea. And the other one, which I think is universal, having been on both sides of this discussion, is that the editor almost always knows more than you do. There's very few instances where your editor knows less than you do in terms of the all. And the ultimate example of this, I don't know how many of you have seen Spotlight, but that was a story that the Boston Globe had covered. It was in their archives. And the new editor came in and his first day on the job said, I think we need to revisit this story, to some very, very experienced reporters who really, really knew what they were doing and understood the communities. And this guy came out of nowhere. He hadn't even lived in Boston. He didn't know anything. And he just looked at it on the face of it and he said, I think there's another story here and I don't think we've covered it. So if I could just summarize my experience on the Daily and what's made it go for all these 125 years, I would say this, that the ability of the editors to consistently identify the stories that really matter, whether it's Selma or something going on in the athletic department or a housing issue or, you know, any kind of discrimination, the editors have been almost uncanny in their ability to call the stories right. And I think that's sort of the ultimate credit to the self-management of the Daily. Thank you.
Thank you, Roger. Well, I wanted to share this story today because we just spoke briefly about civil rights. And this is another one of the Daily's claims to fame. And not many people know that a Daily reporter was actually the first journalist inside Little Rock Central High School when it was being desegregated in 1957. So how did that happen? Well, James Ellsman was the Daily Reporter at the time, and he somehow found an absent student's ID, and he took it and walked right into the school with the rest of the students that day. And he recalled that experience at the Daily's 115th anniversary. So I'm going to read what he wrote. He said, "I was in my seat at 8:45 for my first class at Little Rock Central High School. Ironically, this was a history class. But while these students were studying history, they were also making it. Two seats to my left sat Jefferson Thomas, one of the Brave Nine. When I told him I was an imposter, a reporter from the North, he smiled like any adolescent when someone is putting something over on the teacher. He answered two questions with goodwill patness, well coached by the NAACP. Have any trouble today? No, sir. Expect any more? I don't expect any. Jefferson then bored into his textbook, and I proceeded to snap his picture with a borrowed $15 camera. Time Life later bought this shot, sight unseen, after bidding a top price of $200 on condition that they mail the Daily a print immediately. Now, after irate words with the principal, I was escorted casually outside by a soldier to be dressed down by an officer. Not willing to let me go, he harangued me about how I endangered the lives of all and had further jeopardized press privileges, the privilege of standing outside the school." All right, and we saw Leslie. So many of you probably recall these days, but the Daily is also very well known for its coverage in the 1960s. And this was a time when students held sit-ins in buildings and protests swept campus. And the university administration even called in police forces to try and calm everything down, and hundreds of arrests were made. But September 20th, 1969, was also a very interesting day. A now legendary coach named Bo Schembechler had his first win inside the Big House against Vanderbilt. Now, this is John Papanek. He was a freshman at the time, and he later went on to become the founder of ESPN the magazine and Sports Illustrated for Kids. But he recalled that time in the book. And I just want to read a passage of his story. He said, "Against all odds, 70,183,000 members of this crazy mix pretty much checked their political baggage at the turnstiles and united in spirit inside Michigan Stadium for the debut of the unknown Schembechler. Expecting to be amused partly by a football team no one expected much from, and the rest of the time by the intoxications of the late summer sunshine, cannabis-infused breezes, and slugs of apple wine, the traditional hands-to-hands overhead passing of willing co-eds up the Great Bowl's 90 rows, and, of course, the thunder of 200 marching men of Michigan. There are not yet any marching women. The Wolverines' 42-14 triumph over Vanderbilt turned out to be a pleasant diversion from the serious business at hand, which resumed immediately after the final gun, when 12,000 people massed outside the stadium and moved off on an organized peace march back to the Diag." Now, something else that was rather historic also happened that day. This is Sarah Krulish. She was the Daily's first woman photographer. And in 1968, the press passes for the Big House all said no women, children, or dogs allowed on the field. The next year, the rules had loosened a little bit. They said no women or children allowed. Dogs were okay, because there was a halftime act involving, oh, I forgot the slide. There's a halftime act involving Whiskey and Brandy, who were dogs that kicked a ball down to the end zone. So does anyone remember that?
Little terriers.
Little terriers, yeah.
Wearing maize
and blue jackets, exactly. So Sarah recalled that experience in, well, I just have to read her passage to do it justice. Let me just say that. She said, "On the first day of the season, Andy Sachs, we have the pleasure of right here, a former daily photographer who was covering the game for UPI, agreed to introduce me to the director of sports information, Will Perry. He was sitting in the press box overlooking the stadium. Andy said I worked for the Daily and should be allowed to cover the game. Mr. Perry just looked at us and said he couldn't make the decision right then. So we left and made our way down from the press box onto the field. Three guards surrounded me and asked what I was doing. I said I talked to Will Perry. I didn't tell them what Mr. Perry had said, but they found out soon enough. They told me to leave the field or they would have to physically remove me. When I asked why, they pointed to the part of my pass that said, "No women." "Can't you read?" they asked. I assured them I could, but explained as calmly as possible that I didn't understand why women weren't allowed on the field. I told them I had a right to be there, and I finished by saying I could shoot pictures as well as anyone else on the field. They said they would give me a few minutes to decide whether to leave voluntarily or be dragged off the field. I asked my friends to stay around to document whatever was going to happen, gathered up my courage, and with tears in my eyes, told them that they would have to physically remove me. Right at that moment, the game began. Andy told me just kneel down and start shooting. The seats in Michigan Stadium are at field level, so photographers had to kneel to avoid obstructing views. If the guards had tried to remove me, they would have blocked the views of front row fans and had 100,000 more people as witnesses. They decided to let me shoot. And that is how I became the first woman on the football field at the University of Michigan. Yes. It's one of my favorite stories in the book. Sarah later went on to become the first woman photographer at the Philadelphia Inquirer and the Providence Journal. And she then became the first woman photographer of the culture section at the New York Times. And she's still there today. She shoots over 100 shows a year. But because we have the pleasure of Andy joining us today, I'd love for him to come up and share his thoughts on that experience. And he also wrote about covering some of the Vietnam sit-ins on campus down on Main Street. So come up and join us.
Well, Roger mentioned that that event with Regent Power still haunted him for longer than he predicted. I was sitting in the barber chair not too far from the Michigan Daily, and the barber was doing that sort of delicate part around your ears with a straight razor when he asked me what I did on campus, and I said I worked at the Daily. And he said, "Do you know that SOB Rappaport?" And, you know, he's doing this part with the straight razor, right? I think I said, "I'm not sure. Who do you mean?" You know, when actually Roger and I had both gone to see the Attorney General the day that the decision came down. I said, "No, I don't." He said, "Well, if he was in my barber chair here, I'd cut that ear right off, you know." So we did have a reputation that kind of preceded and followed us around the campus a little bit. Sarah's interaction with the sports department was pretty interesting. I think one thing that she didn't include in her story was the likely outcome of the her removal would be photographed by the AP and UPI and all the other photographers right next to her if she was carried off, plus the 100,000 people that would be watching. So she did endure. She had never in her life shot a football game, so she was kind of making it up when she said, "I can shoot as good as any of the other guys here." That was her first chance, you know, to do that. And she had gone to just a small private school in New York City where there was no football team in sight. My days at the Daily began when I was pretty young myself, when I was 17 and a half years old. I came to college. I was a December birthday, so as a freshman, I showed up here in August, and maybe 17 and two-thirds years old, but still pretty young, and ended up being assigned, instead of to the homecoming day parade in October of that year, that went to the photographers who had been with the paper for quite a while, and one of them was Tom Coppy, who's still a good friend of mine. he said, no, I'm going to take the homecoming parade. I got a motor drive camera that he had rented for this event, and he was going to be right on top of it. I kind of think that he wanted to get next to the homecoming queen and you know, have a little commerce there. So he sent me downtown to the draft board, and he said it's a sit-in. I don't know what's going to happen down there, but, you know, they mostly sit down, so how hard could it be for a freshman to cover this? And I thought, well, okay. I had the gear that I had bought to work for my high school paper, really cheap Spiritone lenses and a Pentax screw mount camera. What else? A flash that took about 15 seconds to recycle. I really wasn't set up for doing news photography in a really good way. But I went down there, and the kids were sitting down. And they were sitting down, and it got to be 3 o'clock and 4 o'clock, and then people came from the police department. There were some more news photographers that came out of Detroit, and they were starting to stand on the top of the desks. You know, just I didn't think you could do that, but you know, these guys from Detroit were doing it, so I thought, well, if they can, then maybe I can too, because you get a much better view. And when 5 o'clock came, the students refused to get up and leave, and the police called more police, and they started taking them out and dragging them out to the hall. And I kind of caught up with this, and it took me a little while to get into the rhythm of the whole thing, but it was, as it turned out, a much more exciting day than going to the homecoming parade. The pictures still, you know, well, I don't get asked for them too often these days, but in that era, you know, from 1965 to about the 70s, people were still asking about that day, and the photographs that I did make were actually pretty good for just a brand new novice on the job. So it was an interesting way to enter the business. And the Daily gave that same opportunity to lots of people, hundreds of them. And I think most of them, you know, who still in the business really seized the opportunity back then. So that's a little bit of a story. Thanks.
And you can see that photo that Andy took in his chapter in the box, which I recommend checking out. Now, besides Sarah, there's a lot of great women who've worked at the paper over the years, and we're lucky to have Laura Berman here today. She's one of them. She's had a long career at the Detroit News, and I'm sad I won't be able to work with her directly anymore, but she wrote about Donald Hall, who became a U.S. Poet Laureate a few years ago. So I would like to invite her up here to share her experience.
Thank you. One of the fun things for me has been getting to know Stephanie and helping her get a job at the Detroit News, which is really such a wonderful thing, just as I was leaving, that she got hired, and it's really nice. And another thing at the Daily, I think it, as I remember, part of what was so exciting about the Daily was there was this hundred, you know, long tradition, and I remember so well that as a freshman that I was there in the early 70s, and the late 60s had been just a really tumultuous, exciting, you know, fractious time in Ann Arbor. And both Andy and Roger were like legends in our newsroom. So it's kind of cool for me to be here today. And I didn't cover breaking news most of the time that I was there. And I was one of the founders of something we called the Sunday Magazine. It was a very pretentious feature section. And our founding editor actually was Tony Schwartz, who went on not that long after, like 10 years later, to write Donald Trump's book, The Art of the Deal, which he's been holding up, you know, this entire campaign.
The best-selling business book
of all time, which he shrewdly made a deal that he had got 50% of the profits. So... I know that a few months ago he tweeted that after Donald Trump had said, I wrote this book and you should read it, and he tweeted, I wrote every single word of it. But I don't think he's been talking about that. Anyway, I'll just talk briefly about Donald Hall. I thought he was an sort of exciting literary figure on campus. He was a professor of English, and I wrote a long profile of him, which enabled me to sit in his office and kind of stare into his eyes and hear his stories and talk about his seductions, and I can't remember it all. But I remember at the time that there was a sense that I had heard gossip in our daily newsroom about him and his second wife, who was this much younger former graduate student, and he had divorced his first wife, and he was sort of an interesting figure. And I'd heard he was in his 40s, that his career was kind of over, and he was kind of trying to write this play at this point that he put on in the Power Center, which was kind of a cool thing about the Wobblies. And when Stephanie asked me to write this piece, I thought about him and how incredibly powerful his life had become after he left the University of Michigan, already as a mature man, and had gone on to write. Far from his career being over, he continually reinvented himself. He'd found the great love of his life. Even though she was much younger, he outlived her by 40 years. And how just the things that we think in college that we know so well, that we understand life, are just really not at all true. So it's my little meditation. Thank you.
Okay. I want to talk about this story a little bit just because it's something that really resonates with everyone and everyone can recall this day. And I'm about to show you actually a few photos of the Daily Newsroom that were taken on September 11th, 2001. So Jeffrey Gagnon was the editor-in-chief on 9/11, and he's actually today an editor at GQ magazine in New York City. But he wrote about that experience for the book. And one of the passages, he said, on the morning of September 11, 2001, the newsroom was swelling with daily staffers who had no idea what was happening in New York. They crowded around the TV to see the towers of the World Trade Center ablaze with black smoke. Near Washington, the Pentagon was on fire too, and a plane had fallen to a field in Pennsylvania. We had no clue what it meant, no clue what it would come to mean later, and absolutely no clue what to put in the paper. Now, what's really remarkable about the Daily's 9/11 coverage is they not only interviewed students and professors to get their reactions, but they actually sent reporters to New York City, to Washington, D.C., to Pennsylvania, and even to Pakistan and Afghanistan to cover the military response. Now, Jeff describes in his story that he actually had to go and approach the Daily business manager and tell him that they needed to replace the photo equipment because one of the Pakistan guards had actually confiscated the Daily's camera. That is not a typical college newspaper experience for you. But speaking of cameras and this day, we're going to fast forward 10 years, and we're going to go to the night that Osama bin Laden was killed, because Chris DeZombeck was the Daily photographer on duty that night, and I was just transitioning from summer EIC to the summer EIC, and I asked Chris, you know, what can we do? Can we get some student reaction for this? And this is one of the great photos that he came back with that night. So I'm gonna let him share how he got that.
All right, so I'm Chris DeZombeck. And so on I forget exactly the date here, May 11th, May 1st of 2011. I had just gotten back a couple hours before this from Chicago, photographing up some theater thing that was happening over there. And I was sitting at the desk in my apartment, editing photos from this play, and scrolling through Twitter on my other screen, because of course that's what you always do when you're sitting at home editing photos, right? And I saw this news break that that President Obama had announced that we had killed Osama bin Laden. And then I heard from Stephanie, and we thought, well, let's see what's happening around campus. And so I got my camera bag, which is still packed from Chicago, and got on my bicycle and rode down to South U, where I figured there are bars there and it's nighttime, and if any students are still around that haven't left for break, this is where we'll find something happening. Rode through the Diag on the way there. I was living up along Huron at the time. And not very many people were even in the Diag. This was right after finals had ended, and I think most of the students had gone. But I did find on South University Avenue this guy who was celebrating by skateboarding down the street, waving an American flag and chanting something like USA, USA. And this was one of two photos, two decent photos anyway, that I came back with this night. The arrow. This was another one. This is in one of the neighborhoods further south of campus. And these three students had been sitting on their porch drinking and singing. I honestly don't remember what, some sort of patriotic country song to celebrate. So I got back to my apartment a little bit later that night and sent these off to the paper. And I don't remember exactly where these ran in print or if they were running online. Okay, yeah. So these ran online. The first photo that we showed was the sort of lead photo with this reaction story. Just one other. I think we have one other photo from my time at the Daily here. This is from back in 2008. This is election night 2008. This is one of several photos that I took of the reaction just as it was announced that then Senator Barack Obama had won the presidential election. And this is out in Battle Creek, Michigan, at a watch party for the election, for some, I forget whose congressional campaign this would have been at the time. I'm sure it's in the caption for this photo. So that's some of my political coverage from my time at the Michigan Daily.
Crystal's in Ann Arbor and bikes around campus. You might see him sometimes. All right. In case you're curious about the Michigan Daily's printing press and how the paper is actually produced, up until the late 1970s, the printer was actually in the basement of the Daily. And obviously, it wasn't around during my time. So I asked Jay Cassidy, who took the Robert F. Kennedy photo, what it was like. And he told me, the rotary press housed in the basement would shake the building when it hit high speed, usually at 4 a.m. in the morning, so few knew. And if you didn't have a scar from a flick of hot lead at some point in your daily experience, you really weren't putting out the paper. And there were a few key people who kept the press running. This was Myron, one of the press operators. And George, another pressman who used to pump lead inside. And Merlin was a linotype operator who set the body text. And Lucius, who's very famous among Daily alumni. He kind of kept the whole thing running and used to set the front page. But a lot of alumni who know him will tell you that if you had a request for a change and came down late at night, on deadline, he would sort of threaten you with his X-Acto knife because, he didn't want to have to change anything. So Laura nodded, do you remember that? Yeah. Good grammarian, do you remember that? But this is the printer today, and it's actually printed about an hour away in Davisburg, Michigan. And about 10,000 copies are printed each weekday, which is down from my time, which was about 16,000 back in 2011, 2012. And this is me watching the paper roll off the press with Sarah Squire, who's now a design graphic editor at the Wall Street Journal. And I bring her up because Sarah and a small team of Daily staffers worked with me on the Daily's first football book, which is a collection of stories and photos printed in the Daily about the football team, starting in 1890 when the paper began. And I actually have a few copies of this book on me today if anyone would like one. There's special edition hardcover, which you really can't find because you can only find soft cover online. So let me know if you would like one later, but they're also on Amazon. And besides the print products, you can also find the Daily online at michigandaily.com. It has a pretty big presence where about 750,000 page views are generated each month, and about 180 countries read the website. And you can also find the Daily on social media, so you know you can follow them on the Facebook page, and they're on Twitter. And a newer development is Instagram, where a lot of graphers showcase some of the photos that maybe didn't get in the print, in the paper or online. Well, this remains where the magic happens every day, 420 Maynard. And of course, now there's Mac computers instead of typewriters in the newsroom. And there's no longer this beautiful printing press in the basement. But as the Daily Show hinted, the Daily is actually now the only daily print newspaper in Washtenaw County. And so that mission to report the news accurately and promptly for 40,000 readers and now people worldwide remains the same. But I'm going to wrap up with one of my favorite quotes in the book. And this was written by Michael Rosenberg, who was a 1996 editor-in-chief and is actually a sports writer at Sports Illustrated today. Because I think it really encompasses why we would all eat, sleep, breathe, spend all of our time at the Daily. He said, "I did not have to spend as much time at the Daily as I did, but I learned one of the most valuable lessons in life, and it's not a journalism lesson. If you love what you do, it won't feel like work, and you will never feel overworked. It helps if you love the people who do it alongside you." So thank you all for being such a great audience today. And to the library and Martin for organizing, and a quick thank you to Jake Serwer, who helped put together some of the videos you saw. And we have books available if you'd like to purchase one, and the contributors are here. They can sign one for you, or you can get one as a gift for somebody else.
Okay. Great job, Stephanie. And we have a few minutes. Does anyone have any questions for Stephanie or Andy or Laura or Roger or any of our guests or Chris? Please feel free. We've got a microphone that we can bring. I just want to mention one of our folks who's in the audience tonight is Diane Tracy from the Bentley Historical Library, and had some pretty major news that she told Stephanie and all of our guests about archiving the Michigan Daily, which is pretty cool. Do you want to talk about that, Diane? Do you mind? Introduce yourself again, please.
Thank you very much. Diane Tracy from the Bentley Historical Library. The Bentley is partnering with both the Office of Student Publications and the University of Michigan Library to hopefully digitize all 125 years worth of the Daily. And what will be different about this project from previous attempts to do part of the daily runs is there will be an OCR search function. So in the past, you had to know which issue of the daily had the story or the photo or whatever you were looking for, and then you could go look for whatever you wanted. When we get through with this project, which we hope to launch for the University of Michigan's bicentennial in 2017, you can just use a word or a phrase in search, and it'll come up with all of the times that it will find a hit. So we have a little test drive. If you go to the Bentley's website, you can mess around with. We've got a couple of months from 1969 scanned in there. It's not the lovely, what we hope will be a lovely portal or front door for it eventually when this whole thing gets built out, but you can test drive the search function, and that's kind of fun to just see. So when I did it, I typed in Pretzel Bell, and so you got hits for all the ads and for the Pretzel Bell or stories about the Pretzel Bell in that 3 or 2 month run from the late 1960s, which is a lot of fun. So we are fundraising for it. It's a hugely expensive project. So if you know anybody who you think might love to support something like that, you can send them my way, because we're really excited about wanting to make this whole thing happen. So that's thank great. You for that.
Excellent.
So you have to go to the Bentley Historical Library's website. So, you know, www.bentley.umich.edu. Yeah, umich.edu, something like that. And you can, we have in a section that says something like news, you can pull that up. And if you still can't find it, you can probably find my email on there and I'll help you out.
Anyone else? Any other questions?
Yeah, any other questions, please?
Okay, yeah, you want to go right over here?
First of all, I'd like to ask, do you expect this project will result in any resignations? thank you all for your presentations. They're really interesting. Couple of questions, really. One is, did any of you ever go to class?
And actually, secondly, one of the things that keeps coming up over and over again, I think Stephanie will verify this, is it's a big deal that none of us had any formal journalism training. Actually, that's not true. I did.
There was a journalism program, and I went to the journalism school.
And I can tell you that the teaching was outstanding. They had a terrific journalism department here at U of M. Yeah. And there were some of us who actually had double majors at the Daily and in the journalism school. However, what the journalism school didn't have was the laboratory that the Daily was, and I think Stephanie has done a really outstanding job of explaining the difference between theory and practice, and that was really, it was sort of like the difference between being in the PE department and playing football.
Right.
I think that would be the best way to explain it.
I kind of wonder if there isn't a little bit of a conspiracy that they don't have a journalism department these days. It just seems strange that a university that has such a reputation and thinks so highly of itself would leave that out.
And actually, there were some real academic superstars on the Daily, hard as it is to believe, people who really went on to great academic careers. That's not something we've talked about tonight.
That's true.
But there's a lot of people who went on to become college professors and, you know, Wall Street gurus and heads of major publishing houses. I mean, you've documented some of it, but people who had great academic careers. So I don't know how it happened.
My co-editor, Howie Brick, is now the Lewis Evans Professor of History at the University of Michigan after a 30-year career at other institutions. Wow. So I think that's pretty cool.
And I worked with a bunch of engineers. I know Chris actually majored in engineering, correct?
Right.
So you didn't have to want to go into journalism to join the Daily. Some people just did it for fun.
We all did it for fun.
We all did it for fun, too. Yeah.
And one other thing, if I may. I think, you know, from talking about the 60s to the present time, even from the pictures, tremendous amount of technological change, you know, in the reporting and in the printing and all the technology. Can you comment on that a little bit and, like, how maybe, you know, in the 60s, I mean, how were people dispatched? I mean, you know, were you using payphones or what, you know?
We did.
Yeah. I built an assignment box, which I actually rescued from the Daily when it was being renovated. It was made out of 2x4s, and it had 7 holes in it. And the holes were big enough to hold a piece of paper that was ripped off an assignment pad. So the assignments were made on an assignment pad. And the picture editor, I was a photo editor for a while, would take those and put those assignments in one of the 7 holes. And the holes were labeled with the days of the week. And if you were a photographer that day, you came in and you pulled the pieces of paper out of the little hole, and those were your jobs for the day. You couldn't say that, you know, I forgot my password or, you know, my phone wasn't charged or any kind of that BS. Take the paper out and read it.
Is there a question over here before?
I just was curious because having lived here a long time and read the Daily for years and years, how good many of the articles are. Did new people come in ever get any, I don't know, official lessons in writing or editing, or did everyone just do it and learn on the job?
There was a lot of hazing.
Really, there was. It was very tough to, when you started out, there would be like 50 people at the first meeting at the Daily, and or 100 people, and there would be a lot of withering criticism.
It was posted on a bulletin board, right?
It was survival of the fittest.
That evolved, though, over the years, I will say.
It was
like,
cruel.
Today, if you want to join the Daily, pretty much anyone can join. You know, there's requirements for each section. So if you want to be a news reporter, you have to write, like, 3 news stories and shadow a reporter, and you're sort of on staff. So I think it became a little more lax throughout the years.
I was a little tougher on the guys on the photo staff. There was a guy who was a native from Singapore, came over here, and his dad kept sending him the greatest equipment from the gray market that he could pick up really cheap over there in China. And this guy, he would go out with his great equipment, you know, f1.2 lenses and stuff, and come back with just the crappiest pictures. And, but excuses, you know, why he couldn't get a better picture of the student council meeting or something. And finally, at the end of the semester, the second semester, I said, Richard, you know, I'll give you 3 weeks at the beginning of next semester to prove yourself. And if it doesn't work out, I just don't want you working on the staff. And it didn't work out, and I fired him. He later went on. I think firing him was maybe the best thing that happened for him. He became the best street shooter for the Detroit Free Press. This is Richard Lee. And he held that position for about 20 years. He was just like an animal out there. You know, if they needed something done that was really hard, they'd send Lee, and he would do it. So there was a lot of criticism. The paper, the front page, used to be posted on a bulletin board, right? And people would write all their remarks in grease pencil on it for everybody to see.
We had a professor from Columbia who we sent the paper to every day, and he would send it back totally marked up with everything we had screwed up on. Bad headlines, you know, copy editing issues. So we were pretty relentless, and those are posted. We took it pretty seriously. I do want to add a footnote. It's a question you haven't asked. Since everybody knows that the New York Times essentially missed the Holocaust, you know, there have been books written about this. They essentially, a Jewish-owned and run newspaper basically did not cover the Holocaust very well. They missed large parts of it, and they've been there have been enormous books written about this subject, and we missed a big story. The story we missed, we never touched, was women in sports, the fact that there were no women's sports teams during our era. In fact, Mickey King, who went on to win the gold in 1972, was one of the women athletes who was allowed to swim in the men's pool as long as she showered in the women's bathroom, restroom, and that the shower was the sink. And these women, she went to the Olympics on her own. She was not allowed to date any men on the swimming team as a conditioner for being snuck into the pool because there was only a men's pool. This was a huge story that we never discussed or even considered covering. It's a subject that never comes up. But I think it's important to know that there were some stories that we managed to miss. And that was an era when feminism was actually definitely, you know, strong. We saw Sarah Coleridge tonight. Yeah. But when she was doing that, there were still no women's teams at that point.
And but the Daily did cover women not being in the marching band, as I recall, I believe.
Hardly, that's right.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that was just a story we missed. And we had a lot of women editors and writers, too.
And women weren't allowed in the field, correct?
But there wasn't a woman editor of the Daily until 72.
We had a great sports department. Andy will vouch for that. We covered sports beautifully. That was just a story we missed.
Someone else?
A couple more.
Oh, hang on just a moment. Yeah.
Every woman from 64 to 68 when I was there had to take 4 quarters of some PE kind of thing. And the first one was posture, figure, and carriage.
Right.
That was what.
There were women's intramural teams, but we didn't cover them. You know, there were club teams, but we didn't cover them.
Posture.
They've been submitted to some medical organization. I don't know.
All right, you have a question down here.
Sorry, I came in a little late, so maybe you touched on this. What about minority employment and involvement with the Daily over the years? Has that kind of mirrored the minority enrollment in the U on a whole basis over the years, or can you anybody speak to that?
I can speak to the recent trends. Maybe you guys can address what happened back then, but I mean, anyone who wants to join the Daily can. We don't really actively go out and recruit anyone to join the Daily, so you know, it's just really a reflection of who wants to join, and it's sort of a reflection of who's on campus at the university too. So as you can imagine, the minority staffers on the paper are lower than Caucasians, but I think that's just a reflection of who's at the University of Michigan.
Has that come up as a potential issue to be addressed by the Daily management in terms of?
And I'm only speaking from my time as editor-in-chief, but so from 2008 to 2012, it's an issue that's always addressed during Daily editor elections, and you know, it's hard because if you want to write for the Daily, you should want to write for the Daily, and the students don't want to necessarily go out and make people write for the Daily that don't want to write for the Daily, if that makes any sense. So it's not like we're going to go to a Black Student Union meeting and target them to write for the paper necessarily. But I don't know if the experience
was
similar.
Well, you know, two of the Pulitzer Prize winners you showed were African-American editors of the Daily, one from my era, Gene Robinson, and the other, Steve Henderson, who's at the Free Press now.
So those people show up. I was on the board and control of publications. They don't call it that. It sounds so authoritarian now. I forget what the exact title is. But I was on the student board publications in the early part of this century. And there was a lot of hand-wringing about this topic. How do we get more, you know, more diversity on the staff? And part of it was that just like a Black fraternity doesn't attract a lot of white guys, the Daily, you know, had this sort of built-in kind of clubbiness that's hard to crack and hard to, yeah, for people who don't feel or look the same to enter into that circle. But going back to my era, which was the 60s, we were conscious of the civil rights movement and all that, and people would come in, and we had a Black photographer named George June, who was a pretty good shooter, and we didn't make much fuss about him one way or the other. Sarah Krawitz wasn't the first woman on the staff to shoot pictures. There were other people. Anita Kessler came before her, and lots followed her, of course, but we were sort of low-keyed about it. Now I think it's more of an issue because of everybody wants to, you know, have a certain official mix of diverse participants. I don't know how it was with you, Chris, in your era.
I was at the Daily in the same era as Stephanie was. We graduated the same year, so I'll mostly. Mostly defer to her answer. I don't remember that we on the photo staff made any particular special effort to recruit any particular group, minorities among them.
Well, I had the Chinese fellow, you know, but I fired him. So, but that was, I thought it was for cause, you know. Later, he became very good at what he did, so.
We do have a comment back here.
Yeah, so I graduated in 2009, around the same time. So just from my experience, I would say, like, with student groups, they always had, and I was with Wolf TV, it was the TV side of everything, but you always had on the first day You know, really the first week in the fall, all the student groups, including the Daily, would be outside on the Diag, actively promoting to all students to join. And so that was a good way for all student groups, including the Daily, to promote what they're doing, take emails. And then after that, it was kind of up to students to show up. And if you wanted to show up and you were hungry and you wanted to write or you wanted to do TV or whatever, that's sort of the process that most students, you know, took.
I'd like to just add a footnote. I don't know if you saw Steve Henderson, our fellow alumni, on Meet the Press last week, but he was appearing with
Mary Madeline.
Mary Madeline. You can tell. You tell.
So Steve's up there, and he's talking about how the Republican Party has been sending a kind of coded message for the last 20 or 30 years about the things that Donald Trump is actually expressing in fairly simple and straightforward terms. And Steve wasn't too shy about being direct in this. And Mary Madeline turned to him and said, when you say things like that, I would just want to choke you. Wow. Right? And this was, you know, it's a pretty heavily watched news show on Sunday morning.
Yeah.
And I thought, why? You know, they have a 7-second delay, but I guess they figured this was good enough to go out on the air. Is that what you meant?
Yep.
Yeah. He did not snipe back at her, but I can only imagine what
she
went on.
She apologized later and invited him down to Louisiana.
What a great fellow! What a great woman that was. Huh?
Folks, we're going to have to wrap up the event, but please, I hope you'll pick up a copy of Stephanie's incredible book. Say hello to Stephanie and all of our contributors. And there's also Michigan football hardcover copies of the Michigan football book available. And please, there are evaluation forms for our event tonight. Thank you all for being here. Let's hear one more time for Stephanie Steinberg, Andy Sachs, Roger Rappaport, Laura Gorman, Krista Zombeck. Great job.